9 p.m. hour.
Blog
Welcome
Talk
to
Radio.
The only world famous Kay Thompson live show with Kay Thompson herself live and in person. And I am also the son, also known as the co-host, also known as Eric Payne. And I will be a co-host along with other co-hosts, Mr. Legendary Newsman Wayne Gilman and our resident historian Byron Saunders. Also, tonight we have our guest, Mr. Bill Katz, will be joining us for the discussion, and we'll be talking about some other things. Of course, the news of the day. Ma, and here she is, the host of the show, Kay Thompson, live and in person.
You sure I'm live and in person, right? Okay. Yes. You know, we were going. The person that we're going to be talking to again tonight is Bill Katz, and he has the latest edition of Indians in this Country, Black Indians. And you have some, there's some fascinating, the latest edition of his book,
okay.
Black Indians. And, you know, it's a, so much other stuff, new things, because there's things that I have read that I didn't realize. And further investigation, and I don't know, he just did a whole lot of information, and it's really fascinating to read. And Black Indians, it's a hidden heritage, and it's not hidden anymore because of the fact that Bill Katz, and Black Indians and Black Americans, as a matter of fact, is going to be calling in and very few minutes. So, and then we're going to be getting into that conversation.
When you talk about what the new edition, what do you mean by the new edition? Has he done more research, additional research?
Yeah. He's added information. It's so complete. And you wonder why it wasn't in the other books, including a lot of, Black authors, who should have known to do a little more research. But I guess they did, and maybe they didn't, but anyway, he has done it. And it's really absolutely one of the most fascinating stories on Black Indians that has been written. And he says that it's a book that gives us much useful, nearly lost, invaluable history, and it makes a contemporary comprehension of alliances between and among peoples possible.
That is a quote by Alice Walker.
Yes, I see that. Yes, that's right. Okay, so there we go. He's going to be calling in very shortly.
Okay, and let me just welcome our resident historian, Mr. Byron Saunders. Hey, Byron, how are you doing today?
Well, it's another blessed day in paradise, like I usually say. And it's cold here in New York paradise. I wish it were a little warmer, my friend.
We're going to be discussing this new – are you familiar with Bill Katz's book, Black Indians? Let's start with the ground. Have you read his first book, his original book, Black Indians, and then you could be – have you heard of his new one? Are you familiar with his book, Black Indians?
I am familiar. I haven't read it. I've read some of the liner notes on the piece, but I am encouraged by any of our historians who share with us the stories of the Black Indians, both in the, of course, across the West, but also those who are here in New York area, the Matinecocks, a very dark-skinned branch of the Shinnecock Indians that are here in the Flushing, New York area and lived here for quite some time. I know some of them, and they're very dark-skinned. So I think Bill is on to his stories, and I read some of the pieces about his new book, which is very encouraging. So I like Bill. I like what he brings to our listeners, and look forward to tonight's ongoing episode.
Well, I think that this is the new edition of his book.
Yes.
So I believe we have him right now. So we'll ask him himself, Mr. Bill Katz. How are you, Bill Katz? How are you?
Fine. How are you all?
Excellent.
We're doing good this evening. We're doing good this evening. Just talking about the latest, the re-edition. Now, this is a re-edition of your book, Black Indian?
Yeah, it's the expanded edition that I had sent to you. And it has a couple of new chapters, a lot of new pictures and documents, yes. I was able to expand on a number of things that I couldn't get in the original book.
And this is information that you already had, that due to editing you had to cut back, or is this additional research that you've done and decided to include it in this new edition?
Well, it was both. I had some. You see, the original book was designed as a young adult book, and the publisher restricted me to 200 pages, just under. And this time, I talked them into this expanded edition. It's about one third larger. And it's got new individuals in there that weren't in the original edition and so on. So it really fulfilled the wish I wanted to do originally.
When you say young adult edition, so that, would that make it have, was the intent for it to be a textbook?
It's been used in schools. It's been used, I think, from about the sixth grade up. But what we found is soon after the book came out, even though it was designed as a young adult book, adults were buying it. I mean, I found it selling on the, the street corner book hawkers all the way from 125th Street down to my area here of 6th Avenue and 8th Street was selling the book. They weren't selling it to children.
Well, you know, you're putting down some knowledge, as the kids in the street say, if the brothers on the corner of 125th Street were telling you a book on black history and black Indians, that must mean, like the Jamaican friends say, that it must have been the real article for that. But at least my mom, she has a couple of things.
I'm telling you what. Black Indians, as a matter of fact, you start this with your introduction, you say black Indians, the very words make most people shake their heads in disbelief or smile at what appears to be a joke, a play on words. Have you found that to be so, Phil?
Oh, yeah. Actually, Gary Bird was reading it in the subway one time, and a white guy came up to him, and he just looked at the cover there, and he looked at Gary and he said, "They were not."
They were not. What were you trying to say? The Indians weren't black?
The black, no black Indians, never heard of them. Couldn't be there. Never saw them in a Hollywood movie, so they couldn't be there.
That's why.
And I encountered that in various degrees. Yeah. Also, I have to say, even some young black people came up to me. One I remember at John Jay College after I spoke there, tears in her eyes. And she said, I had no idea of this. And what she was doing, unfortunately, I told her, I said, you're blaming yourself for what's been a whiteout of history.
Uh-huh.
So let me ask you real quick. You said, what was the... And I don't mean to be dominating the conversation,
yeah,
but I'm inspired to ask some questions as you're speaking to me now. Gary Bird said a white guy walked up to him on the train and said there were no black Indians. And that sounds like it was antagonistic. The young black woman didn't know there were black Indians, and she sounded compassionate. And it just makes me wonder about the psyche of it, because I'm wondering if the white guy was trying to say, I don't know what he was trying to say, that you weren't here. I mean, to admit that black people were Indians, there were black Indians, that would mean that black people were here before Christopher Columbus and everybody else from that part of the world might have discovered America. So that would suggest that the Africans traveled, or maybe, who knows, long ago. You guys, as historians here, it just makes me ask these questions. I'd be interested to hear the resident historians' questions or comments on that, Byron Saunders as well.
Well, just to add something, Ivan Van Sertimer, who is a professor down at Rutgers, said that they came before America.
Right, that's
you
what
see?
I was thinking about.
So, yeah, so this is what Phil Katz is telling us. Now, he's done the research and he knows. And I know a whole lot of people don't believe it. A lot of black people don't believe it. But in our own family, we have found this and
right.
So many other people.
We've known that.
Yeah.
Having known that, having that history in our family, we've known that. So it's not a bizarre thing.
But, some people, even in the black community, really object to that.
Right.
I don't know why.
I would assume, and I want to get our other two guests in. I would assume that, the Indians were had a negative stereotype, looked down upon another people that were conquered, so to speak. If you look at the broad picture, and that African-American, sub-African-Americans don't want to feel doubly damned. I guess that's the only thing I would think.
But, yeah. You know, also, I should say, in my reading, and Bill, you can, confirm this if you want, Hampton University, Hampton College in Virginia, they were the first college to accept the Indians. So that's a fact. But, you know, I want Bill Patton to finish
yes.
on this line. Bill,
yes, that's true. And I have a section on that in Black Indians, because the person put in charge was the later to become very famous Booker T. Washington. And he
right.
was put in charge of the Native Americans that were taken in there. But I also find there was another. See, when I was doing my book, putting it together, before I even got it to the publisher, I had a whole bunch of friends over one night. And then somebody asked, Bill, what's your next thing that you're doing? And I said, well, I'm doing this book on Black Indians. And all of the Black people that were there that night, whom I had known for years, said to me, oh, you mean like my family. Now, they hadn't
mm-hmm.
ever said that to me before. So my interpretation of that, this was in the early 1980s, and people were
mm-hmm.
still enthralled with the Black is Beautiful movement. You know, I'm proud of my African heritage. And so the Black Indian part, I admit it was also not well known, but it was also underplayed, lest people think they were ducking away and not taking real credit for their African heritage.
Mm.
I think that was the thing that was played out.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was my sense.
Let's put a pause and let me get our other calls and welcome our other calls, Wayne Gilman, into this discussion as well, into the show. Legendary newsman, Mr. Wayne.
All right, good evening, everyone. Forgive my tardiness, but sounds like a very stimulating conversation thus far with Dr. Katz. How are you, Doctor?
Great to talk to you again, Wayne.
Yeah.
Good.
You know, it's interesting, just to piggyback on what you just said. I happen to have a good friend. In fact, the young lady is an avid listener of Kay Thompson, going back to WLIB. She is the aunt of Tawana Brawley. And the deal is that she is a Black Native American. And over the years, in my knowing her, has exposed me to powwows that take place in Connecticut,
mm-hmm.
Shinnecock, Long Island, and
yes.
I didn't know there was such a huge population of Black Native Americans until I was really involved in getting to know her and her family.
Yes. Actually, my good friend Chief Osceola of the Matinecock is in the process of writing a new introduction for my book for young people on the subject, Proudly Red and Black, stories of
mm-hmm.
about six Black Indian who made a mark in American history. And he and I have teamed up at various times speaking to groups, and he is the chief of the Matinecock, who are also very clearly in ancestry Black Indians.
Wow,
I will
Dr.
be, by
Kat.
The way, yes,
yeah, this is Byron here. For 8 years, I ran the Queens Historical Society, and Chief Osceola and I became good friends as well. And it was an eye-opening, and listening to his story about
yes.
being a branch of the Shinnecocks. But yes, the Matinecock branch being a very dark Black Indian,
yes.
Native American Indian. And Chief Osceola gives a wonderful story about his family and the traditions of the Matinecocks in the
yes.
Flushing, New York area.
Yes. Actually, I hope to include, when I get bring this book back into print, this Proudly Red and Black, a
mm-hmm.
magnificent picture he sent me of the group all together sitting there, the men and the women in their tribal costumes and so on, as well
wow.
In the introduction that he's written.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
yes, definitely.
I wanted to mention.
Go ahead, Kay. No, go ahead.
I just wanted to mention to your listeners, lest we leave it out, that I'm going to be appearing on Wednesday, May 24th of this month, 6:30 p.m. at the Brooklyn Society for Ethical Culture. I know many of your listeners are probably from New Jersey, but I'm assuming some of them are from New York or maybe working in New York and may want to attend. It's free, and they called it very generously an evening with William Lauren Katz. But what I'm going to be speaking about is how the history of Black Indians and a lot of the other history books I've written show the story of resistance, a story that many people really need to know today when they feel so lost and feel their government is not behind them and they don't know what to do. And they don't know that there's a whole history, particularly among people of color, of resistance to tyranny that goes way back before the Declaration of Independence and the War of Independence. So I just want to invite people out there. It's free. It's Wednesday, May 24th, 6:30 p.m., Brooklyn Society for Ethical Culture. The address is 53 Prospect Park West. And I hope to see many of you there. Yeah, 53 Prospect Park West.
And that's at the Brooklyn Society of Ethnic Culture. Is that it?
For Ethical Culture. Brooklyn Society for Ethical Culture. And Muriel Tillinghast is going to be the master of ceremonies at the program.
Okay.
And I'll
be
taking questions, and I think I'll have some books there if people are interested.
Yeah. Sure.
And that's May 24th.
May 24th.
Right.
Yeah. That just sounds like somebody either trying to get through to us or to you. But anyway.
Dr. Katz, I have a question for you. With respect to President Trump's recent acknowledgement of Andrew Jackson, of course we know Andrew Jackson was instigator of the Trail of Tears, which rounded up many of the East Coast Native tribes from North Carolina, South Carolina. I have Cherokee in my family and have been to powwows at Etowah in Etowah, Georgia. And in your comments, your thoughts, Dr. Katz, when you heard this, and of course, you know a lot more of a lot about the Trail of Tears, and your thoughts about what Mr. Trump had to say about Andrew Jackson.
Well, I don't think it's surprising that he likes Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson and Mr. Trump have a lot in common. Andrew Jackson in his day was not only a slave owner, but a slave trader, and he had no use for people of color, and his actions proved that. He was the one that back in 1814 or 1816, I forget which date, it's in my book, he launched the invasion of Florida from the United States because Florida had become a haven for runaway slaves from Georgia and the Carolinas. They didn't head north. Everybody thinks of the Underground Railroad heading north. Yes, it did. But it also ran south for those closest to Florida because they had a base of operations there. The Seminole Nation was actually started when Africans who lived in Florida, who were the first to escape, welcomed Seminoles who were fleeing from the Carolinas and Georgia and Alabama into Florida, and they built a multi-ethnic, I guess we'd call it today, nation, because they had the same enemy. The slave catchers were after both of them. And we have to remember, it's very important to remember, the first people enslaved here in the Americas were Native Americans. The Europeans who landed grabbed anybody they could. They would have enslaved their own grandmothers. if they had a chance. And they didn't want to do the work, and they wanted to force others to do it. And as but the Native Americans, they came with a problem. They had friends in nearby villages and in the forests, and they could escape. So they had a means of not only escape, but coming back with an armed force. So it was very dangerous to enslave Native Americans. So then Africans were brought in. But the Africans quickly got the idea, as they were out there on the frontier, that the Native Americans were not their enemies. They were not part of the enslaving force. And they, whenever they had a chance, they escaped to Native Americans. Native Americans, and this is important, took them in, having had the taste of slavery the Europeans inflicted on them. They knew that the enemy of their enemy could be their friend, and it sure proved that way, because the Africans brought tremendous gifts to the Native American villages. They, first of all, had a very clear understanding, having gone through the slave trade, what the Europeans were like, that you couldn't take their word, that you had to arm against them. And, of course, Native Americans at that point saw no need to fight against this heavily armed, well-equipped army alone. So the Africans were very important allies. And in Florida, which is what I'm focusing on now, and by the way, and Black Indians, I have three chapters on them, you had the strongest conglomeration and unity and fighting force ever to face, that is, of Africans and Native Americans together, ever shaped in North America. This was the strongest station, you might say, of the Underground Railroad. This was the most widespread, successful, and longest-lasting slave rebellion in American history, because it lasted from that invasion that Andrew Jackson launched all the way to 1858. That's just a few years before the Civil War. And some Seminoles say they never gave up. Of course, many of them were finally agreed to migrate under, they were forced out by Andrew Jackson and President Van Buren, and they migrated out, shipped out to the Oklahoma Territory, where they took up their headquarters.
So what, that was under Jackson's, Andrew Jackson's
I can't hear you.
That shipping out to the territory, was that under Andrew Jackson's administration?
It was actually it was initiated at that time and carried out, and I have to say this, by a New Yorker, a President Martin Van Buren. He not only carried it out, but I have the quote in there. He even issued a statement afterwards saying, the movement of the people out there has been done without any difficulty, and they went willingly. Something like that. It was pure nonsense.
Well,
the army went out there. Thousands of troops were used. People faced bayonets, and their crops were destroyed, their property seized, and they were forced to march out with just about all they could carry.
But it's
a perfect example of how the unity was forged early on.
The unity, you
if
mean
I
the
might
unity
add
for,
a, if
what,
I might
you
add
said,
an,
you
another,
mean the unity, you mean Bill, you mean
yes.
The unity of the nation when you say how the perfect example of how the unity was formed. What do you mean? What
the unity formed by the Native American nations and the Africans.
Okay. To decide that they had to come together. I was asking about Andrew Jackson because I know that he was he before Van Buren or after? I'm thinking about Donald Trump's reference, I believe it was to Andrew Jackson, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. And maybe some of you guys could help me with that. He just was praising Andrew Jackson a couple of weeks ago, I believe. And was Andrew Jackson? Yeah, was not he involved in being very harsh on Native Americans as well as president?
Well, yes. I mean, he was the one that he and the Congress at that time initiated the Trail of Tears, in which, by the way, thousands died.
Right.
It was like the Bataan Death March.
Right.
And by the way, many Africans were among those that went out with the Cherokees and the Chickasaws and the other nations there.
And also, Bill, I understand that two Brazilian black Indian communities were commanded by African women, according to your book, and another African Maroon settlement was in 1826 in Brazil, and it was ruled by a black woman whose name was Zeferina.
Zeferina?
And she, yeah, Zeferina, right? Am I saying it correctly? Zephyr? And
yes.
She had led her army or her forces against different plantations in Bahia. Can you tell us more about her?
That's right. Yeah.
That's the first time I've heard
about
her.
No, well, actually, yes. And women played a prominent role in these Maroon settlements. They didn't have to follow. The Europeans followed, where they separated men from women, and women could not rise to any power and were subjugated. Women played a role that was very important, and even the lifeline, the parental line, was determined by the parentage of the women. So it really goes, it's what's called a matriarchal society. I go into that in detail in the book. I'm sorry, I know we have limited time, so I can't go into too much detail.
Yeah.
But can I mention one other thing? I came on a statement, you know, when we were all focused on what was happening with the Dakota Pipeline that was being opposed at the Standing Rock Reservation, where more than 100 Native American nations joined together. And a group went out, a large group, and I have a photograph of them on my website, from Black Lives Matter. And they issued this statement. It's short. I'd like to read it. Black Lives Matter stands with the Standing Rock, as there are many diverse manifestations of blackness, and black people are also displaced indigenous people. We are clear that there is no black liberation without indigenous sovereignty. America has committed and is committing genocide against Native American peoples and black people. We are in an ongoing struggle for our lives, and this struggle is shaped by the shared history between indigenous peoples and black people in the America, connecting that stolen land and stolen labor from black and brown people built this country. I think that's a wonderful statement for today.
Yes.
Right, and we're going to end it right there, Bill. That's a perfect way to end this segment, talking to you about black Indians. We appreciate the... as always, you coming on and sharing that information with us. We want to encourage everybody to pick up the new updated version of Black Indians, the well-respected black historian and Native American study on Native American history by William Loren Katz. I want to thank you once again, Bill, for joining us. And as always, we'll be talking to you again soon.
Thanks,
good.
Bill.
Great talking to all of you. Okay, good night, Kay,
okay.
And everybody.
Have a good night.
Good night. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Wow.
Wow. Always a lot of information and, you know, new things. A lot of people never heard of it before. But the interesting story, another interesting story to me is what I mentioned about Hampton University, that they were the first university, Hampton College or, you know, university, I don't know. But what was it, Eric? You weren't there in Hampton.
Yeah, I don't know. I wasn't there. Booker T was there.
No, but I'm saying in general, what's the name of the college?
It's Hampton.
Hampton
University. Yep.
Okay. So they were the first to, you know, accept Indians. And I remember reading in one of their books, as a matter of fact, that they had a little difficulty with some of the Indian students because of the fact that they refused to. They didn't want to leave their blankets behind. They came in full, you know, their clothes that they wear. So the war, rather. But anyway, we want to get into some politics. Everybody's itching to talk about Trump.
Well, yeah.
Trump. That's it. Trump.
Well, we could take a different tack. That's why we talked about Bill Katz first, because of course everybody's talking about the breaking news that Trump fired Comey. And you guys know I've been talking about it, right? I've been trying to say that this guy, Trump, I'm talking about, is trying to, take care of all as Michael Corleone said, today I handle all family business. He's trying to put all the pieces in place, get rid of all the people who would oppose him in pulling the wool over everybody's eyes that he didn't commit treason and act in cahoots with the Russians to steal this election. And just look at today, if you look at the pictures and the images of him with that arrogant Secretary of State from Russia who sarcastically answered Andrew Mitchell's questions about, oh, did they fire Comey today? Almost as if that's kind of the old image of the Communist Party. When you see movies and they're kind of trying to play that character that they're open to their society. You know, the stereotype image of the Russian to Americans in movies has always been the one who's clamped down on a society, right? So, and if you have your phone open, you might want to mute it because we can hear you jumping around. But in the old movies, the Russian guy has always been the one like, oh, there's nothing wrong. Our society is open, with the wink, wink, and the nod, nod, like they better not ask no questions. And that was what this Russian Secretary of State's vibe was. And just for him to have that arrogance in the United States, where we are supposed to be the polar opposite of that, was deep to me. And then you see every picture of the meeting released was released first by the Soviet media of Trump with the Secretary of State, of Trump with their ambassador. So he's trying to complete this act of treason. And Comey's the one who's standing in the way because he knows what time it is. We are at some unbelievable times in the United States. They call it Nixonian. I think it's much worse than that.
Yeah.
Don the Con. They need to lock him up because they're running this administration. This is me talking. This is my opinion. That administration is being run like a crime organization to me. If you watch these people taking advantage of the networking possibilities and Jared Kushner's sister dropping his name in China and Ivanka getting the trademark deal after she meets with the president of China, this is ridiculous. These guys getting ready to open up the Arctic Circle to drill for oil up there. I got to tell you something. I was sitting with a group of kind of working class white guys working on something, and they walked up and they were kind of joking about Trump. Yeah, he's really trying to pull it over. I was like, yeah, he's trying to cover his tracks. They're like, yeah, you know, a couple people were kind of agreeing. It was interesting because I know probably all of them or most of them voted for Trump. I said, now if y'all would just admit. All of y'all that voted for him, y'all would just admit that you voted for him, that it was a mistake, that your mother made a mistake. And that kind of quieted the table. And then I was like, well, I like him. I just like him on TV. I'm interested to hear you guys' thoughts. I know you guys are ready to see that, but this is crazy right about now. This is stuff you see in movies.
I think, Eric, your commentary put the really spin on it, especially to quiet the table down, and that's probably what happens. But I think ultimately the one winner out of all of this sordid mess must be our Constitution. You see, if this nation is to sustain its credibility as a world power, we must be a nation that respects its own laws and governmental order. You see, no one individual or party affiliation has the permission nor the authority to override or circumvent the one thing that unites us all in this nation. And that one thing that guides us to the better beacon of justice and liberty is our Constitution. So we got to stand for it, you know?
Byron, I feel you on that. But really, what I've learned in the course of my life, for certain places I've been thinking about or paths I've gone down to think about the situation, is that there's two set of rules, two storylines. The ones that the people who wrote that Constitution say, write the Constitution, do as I say, and what they actually do. Or another way to put it is the haves and the have-nots, or the elite in this country, the 1%.
Yes.
That's why you have a businessman, elect him because he's a businessman, and his whole flavor is, I'm going to do whatever I want to do. If he was a politician, he would understand at least the intricacies of how to get that done. You can still do whatever you want to do because that's what the Bushes did, right? That's what George Bush and them, because that was the last Republican administration, and they got in under kind of janky circumstances too. But they know how to work the system because they've been a part of government, and at least there's some track record that they were concerned about the community while they were hooking themselves up and being part of the powerful in this country. So I've begun to wonder if that very piece of paper that we always refer to is nothing. It's just a piece of paper. And it's some thoughts and ideals that would be great and are lofty to put on the wall and teach people. But the way America has really put it down for centuries has been the exact opposite of that. And maybe I'm sounding a little revolutionary and Black Panther and all that, but when you look at the history of the course of this country, they haven't been living it like that. They haven't been walking it like that, right? We got to.
There's no question about that, Eric. Absolutely. I mean, everything that you're saying is on point, and Trump got elected on the premise of going against the popular theory of having an experienced, seasoned politician. He felt by bringing a certain business acumen that would change the direction of the country. This government, as Byron has pointed out, and according to the Constitution, has been set a certain way. It will continue to run that way regardless of who's president. But I think what we're seeing now is the beginning of the end a lot sooner than what we anticipated. You know, I would say in a year at least. Excuse me. The smoking gun is out there. And you know, just the manner in which he went about this whole dismissal with Comey I'm saying it's breathtaking, but it's in a completely negative way. His poll numbers have sunk. He intends to follow a certain mindset that he's being advised to send. One thing that disturbed me completely last night, I happened to channel surf as I got in the house and I was watching a little bit of Fox. And I saw that, and I hate to say this, but he's a walking cadaver. I would say worse, but we're on the air. Our former mayor, Rudolph Giuliani, was sitting there trumpeting the decision by Trump, if you will, forgive the pun there, about his decision to get rid of Comey. But
of course, all
from what I see, he may be the very next person in line to take that job. And I think that would be the beginning of our end, if that were to happen.
Wow.
I mean,
there
would be such anarchy, particularly coming from New York. I don't know how he's seen or observed across the country, but you know, there is something wrong with him.
Rudy.
You know, and it's been that way for some time.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's just some of the statements that come out of his mouth, some of his
right.
way of twisting the law, you know, just the racist, you know, polarizing demeanor that he's had for such a long period of time.
Of course.
You know, it's not going to change.
Dave Dickens beat him. And let me just shoot this out at you. That's why you're causing me, I mean, you're inspiring me to have some thoughts on that and to spin off what you're saying, Wayne, because I think first, he has that. He's been like that ever since Dave Dickens beat him. beat him for mayor. He's been really, really mad at black. He's been really mad at black people. That's one. And it's kind of funny, but that's kind of true, though, right? Secondly, Rudy's the one who tipped this whole thing off. Because if you remember that interview, and I know my brother Byron remembers it, the interview where he said we got something a couple weeks before the election, right? That we got either Fox or somebody. We got something coming down the pike. Basically, I'm paraphrasing. That's going to change the whole game. Remember he said that?
Oh, yeah, yes. Right.
Definitely.
And this is what they were and the whole email dump and Comey revealing it. That was exactly what it was. You know why? Because it was coordinated. I mean, all we got to do is, I mean, it's circumstantial evidence allows them to be just that, circumstantial. But if you look at the smoke, the line is becoming real clear. And this guy is trying to get as much as done. Now he's starting to panic because now he's making irrational acts, running it like a CEO. And the trick is that he doesn't understand, see, that it ain't the American government is not a company. You don't own America. It's because you got elected. And he's trying to have that approach. I own this place, so let me tell these people what to do. And he thought Comey was his boy. He could kind of get him because he's always making deals. That's what he said. He's a deal maker. So whatever deal is going to be good for him at the time, he's going to make that deal. But that means that the deal he made with the person before that to get to that next step means nothing to him if it doesn't benefit Trump, which means that his word cannot be trusted. That's what everybody doesn't understand. It can only be trusted for that time, and it benefits him. And if it mutually benefits you at the same time as benefiting him, then cool. That's why he was cool with Comey, right? Until he found out that was a Jersey boy.
That's why he praised on him. I mean, just the manner in which he fired the guy, you know, it's like, thank you for not finding anything, any collusion between me and that whole Russian scandal. But, oh, by the way, you're not doing a good job. Goodbye. You know what I mean? It's like no finesse whatsoever. I mean, the man is, you know, I mean, and the thing is, if he should appoint Giuliani, I would anticipate the same demeanor, you know? I mean, Byron, you've been around as long as I have. Maybe you could chime in on that, too. You've witnessed some of the things. I know Kay has.
Absolutely. One of the question marks that will come back up that's going to bite everybody is Jeff Sessions' recusal of his being involved in anything involving the investigation of the hack or that of Hillary Clinton. Now, when you read the order that was recently given as the rationale for firing the Attorney General, the mention was not about a Russian hack, but was about Hillary. And so here you have, we all know that against his better discretion, the nauseated feeling that Comey had at the time that he dropped that bomb on the election process was that he could have been fired then as a result of his not following the orders of the Attorney General.
Mm-hmm.
He violated it. Lynch told him, don't do this. So at the point at which we have to go back on the timeline and
he was working for the Republicans.
He was a Republican. Exactly.
No. He dropped the bomb about Hillary's information before the election. He was working for Barack Obama. That was before Trump got elected.
Yes, he was. Yes. And he could have been and should have been fired then. But for the Trump administration now to claim that the reason why they fired him at this point was not about the Russian hacks, but what he didn't do to
Hillary.
Indict Hillary is just pure poppycock. Okay, excuse my friend.
Of course, you're absolutely right, Byron. And might I remind the audience that Donald Trump, shortly after, I think if it was the next day after, because he was stirring the rallying cry about her up, lock her up,
he said
she should not be locked up because he won the election.
Yeah.
Trump was praising Comey. That's the whole crazy thing. He was praising him back then, just recently praising him just last week, as did Spicer, said he's doing a good job. Now, they come out and claim the president's been wanting to fire him for a while. I think he decided he wanted to fire him when Comey wasn't backing up off of his investigation of him once he became president. And also, too, most recently, I heard in the news the other day that he was talking about that Comey wouldn't give him a heads up upon what he was going to say when he testified the other day. And I think also what lit a fire into Trump was when Comey testified a couple of weeks back and said that they found, was talking about, alluded a little bit, that the investigation into Trump was going on since July. I think that might have been the very first time. But I think Trump probably has started putting he started moving closer to Trump's eyesight or gun sights when he started releasing that type of information. And the fact that he didn't get fired under Obama's administration shows that he was willing. Well, it put Obama in a bad place. They couldn't fire him because it was right before the election because he released that information. I suppose he was going against the grain when he went against Loretta Lynch's advice, you know, but there was no comeback, I guess, or consequence for him during that time because Obama's hands were tied, right?
Well, yeah,
we're talking after the election or just before?
I think
before the
election.
Let's get the event of orders in place. When he first revealed the last dump, he was under the Obama administration. That's why it affected the election. Okay.
Right, exactly.
Right.
So that's what caused Hillary to lose. He stayed on into Trump's administration. So I mean, you know. The FBI chief.
That sequence of events, it's accurate. I mean, the reason why he stayed on is because Trump indirectly credited him for the win that he enjoys, you know, at the moment. But it seems like the minute something goes against what he wants, as you said, he comes out and he's ready to fire people. And you know, I'd forgotten because I come from an era of J. Edgar Hoover, who held the held that post for 1,000 years, and I didn't realize until I was reminded today, yeah, the president has the authority to get rid of the attorney general, but at the same time, you know, you have to look at how the whole patent plays out, and the fact that he's he's putting the burden on Sessions as having been the decision maker. But you know, just because he wants more funding to investigate what this man has been through, I mean, it's so disingenuous. And I was so glad to see members of the New York delegation come out today, and I saw Congressman Payne at the very top of the Channel 4 newscast at 6 o'clock. I'm assuming that he's chiming in with the rest of the members of the caucus, you know, calling for an independent prosecutor, because this is the only way this thing's going to be solved, man. I mean, and to me, it's just ironic that he took pictures, Trump that is, with Henry Kissinger in the White House today, of all days, for this to happen, you know. And it to me, you know, history has a tendency to repeat itself. You know,
yep.
Fasten your seatbelts. I think we're about to go through the same thing a lot sooner than what, you know, we have been predicting.
Well, you what's know, really interesting is that Comey basically was the firewall that kept – that was really keeping the Democrats and most of the Republicans in order to keep from bouncing on Trump full throttle. And now that he's gone, the snowball is rolling down the hill. So it's I think if masterfully, when all of this is written out historically and every move that was made on the chessboard, leaving Comey in might have been the most brilliant of all moves by the Obama administration, because at the point at which everybody keeps pointing back to Comey as knowing more information about everything than anybody else in the investigation. And now that
Do you think he's going to tell all, or do you think what do you think is going to happen? Anybody?
I think the potential for him to drop pearls, but let's face it, he doesn't have to really drop anything, because he had very loyal assistants in the FBI. Comey was very well liked, so any one of his loyal underlings could accidentally drop leaks into the press. In fact, there was a story today that suggests that Comey actually had a dead man's release with respect to if anything happened to him, leaks would be coming out, and they're already coming out. So I mean, there's a point at which there's stuff that's hitting the fan, and it can't be stopped now. It's on.
Here's the thing too. Here's the thing too. I think that the thought process, as I see it, is that Trump thought that Comey, I believe, probably thought that based on Comey's actions, that he might have in fact been corruptible, or might have been able to play ball, get him to play ball with him. He thought he maybe was his guy. Maybe hold on for a second. Maybe leaning in that direction. And I think that might have been suggested because of the actions that Comey had taken when he first came out and cleared Hillary, then came out and dropped that bomb 11 days before the election. I think the Republicans probably, or an individual like Trump, I'm spitballing here, but I could hear him say, well, maybe I could play ball with this guy. Maybe he is swayable to our side. And I think, and it was suggested on the news today also, they found out, and part of Comey's reaction, because you know, a lot of people thought that I was thinking that maybe he was on that side trying to act like he was fair and partial in his treatment of Hillary. But I think maybe what Trump really found out is that, and Comey said he made a mistake. So maybe what Trump found out that Comey is, like everybody's been saying, a straight arrow, that he's got integrity of people because, to a fault, they said, that he was independent in his thinking, that he wanted to make sure things, maybe this is one of those people who is a policy person, an agency person, and is about the duty and honor of serving the country, which you find in a lot of people who aren't the politicians, you know, the people who have to make it all work. To see the unity of making the government work and protecting, like the career FBI and CIA agents and those people that you never hear about, that they don't get the praise. Those are like Sally Yates was. That's what they found out about Sally Yates. She was there to do a job and serve the people.
Job,
serve the country, like you cited. So maybe he found out that Comey was, in fact, despite what he heard and thought, said, no, he's a straight arrow. He's not going to play ball, and he's asking me for more money? for the investigation? That's why, and then he fires him? I mean, you know, maybe that's what he thought, that this guy was really going to get into it. I mean, if he really wanted to play a chess game, though, he probably would have given them more money. And instead of every step of the way, Trump is sounding like a guilty criminal waiting to be found out,
waiting for
the evidence.
And
if you look at the people
I'm just
that he
nervous
fired,
about, you know, about Giuliani, because, I mean, if Pence, if things go according to how it should, and Pence inherits the throne, you know, those are just two conservative elements I think this country could do without right now.
You know what?
You know, Wayne.
I've got a caller. I want to know if the caller wants a bunch of chime in here, or if you're just listening. I know some people like to call and just listen. Hey, caller, I'm opening your mic now if you want to take part in this discussion. I'm sorry you've been out for quite a while.
Hello?
If you don't want to take part, then I can understand that, too. All right, you were going to say, Byron?
I was just going to say that of the firings, of Trump's firings of the Justice, within the Justice Department, Sally Yates, Comey, the circuit judge who from New York here, who basically was summarily released after being promised that he could stay on in the administration. I understand that when he was released, the night before he was fired, or a couple days before, he turned all of his evidence over to the Attorney General for the state of New York.
Right.
So what you have is, and remember, our state attorney general that a couple days ago said to the Congress and the United States Senate, go right ahead, pass that Affordable Care Act legislation, because the minute you do, I am suing you.
Wow.
Eric Schneiderman said this. That's exactly right.
Right, that's right.
So he said, go ahead, pass it to Mitch McConnell.
Yeah.
Go ahead, pass it, because I will sue you immediately when that signature hits that document.
And he's going to enjoy doing it.
So there's so much. That's right. But you know what is really, I think, is even more incredible, and I know we don't have much time, but I really want to put this on the table, guys. Trump is attempting to abridge the Constitution through executive orders. And think about this. That 501c3 nomenclature that he signed the other day with the religious institutions.
Oh, yeah.
Think about This is a very dangerous precedent, because it was under the Reagan administration when the religious institutions were allowed to apply for federal funding. But what I find very disturbing is that this is selective, because your public education institutions, every cultural arts institution in this country that's not for profit is a 501c3. And by singling out just religious institutions, to have this waiver is very dangerous. Church.
Well, I mean, that law goes back
state.
To time when Lyndon Johnson was in the
Lyndon
Senate.
Lyndon Johnson. That's
yeah,
part of
you
the
know,
70,
that's going
64,
back almost 60 years
that's right.
now.
That's part
you
of
know.
The 64 Civil Rights Act. So, I mean,
right.
this president has made, through Bannon, has declared an attack on our Constitution and wants to change it. And he's doing so by executive orders, and this is very dangerous, what's going on.
Very beginning to hear from him. Listen, there's one thing I want. Wait. I just want to ask one thing. What's the story about Loretta Lynch? Where is she? Anybody
well,
know?
Loretta Lynch.
She is probably, you know, amongst those watching, you know, former Obama appointees who lost their position, obviously, and the thing is that she like Obama probably are being very quiet and just watching how things are played out. She, you know, she would be a great guest to get on. I mean, she lives in Brooklyn in Prospect Heights, and
give
I'm
me
certain.
Her number and
I just put some. Beg your pardon.
I said, give me her number and I'll call her.
Well, I would love to get it. I know where she lives. I just don't want to. I don't know the number offhand. And again, you know, she might have
a
gag
I'm
order.
Quite sure,
you know,
Wayne, I'm quite sure, Wayne, that you can get it. pretty please.
You know, there are a lot of numbers I used to be good at getting, but since I have all this gray hair now, I don't know.
Oh,
that's
another
story. Yeah.
Pretty please.
I'll try, Kay.
I think,
I'll stand in front of a door.
And all those folks have been let go, unfortunately, with the new administration. And it would be interesting to see.
But I think that, but Eric, in all honesty, I think they're going to have them. They're going to be gagged. They're not going to want to talk right away.
Well, yeah,
you know.
I mean, unless they have to. But what I was just going to say. Is that a lot of times, you know, people in public service, those who are lawyers, they go into these big power law firms. I would really like to see, it would be interesting to see a big power black firm with Holder, named Holder, Lynch, Obama. You know, I mean, those are three.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, as you know, the president is an attorney, as is the former attorney general.
Uh-huh.
And his succeeding one, Loretta Lynch, that would be a really great thing. You wanted to say, Ma?
Yeah, but, you know, come to think of it, this really is a serious question. What happened to Loretta Lynch? Where is she?
She's probably living her private life.
I mean, that's the only thing that,
it's not like,
can tell with these people. With those
okay, but I'm sure they probably didn't bump her off or anything like that. I don't know. Sounds like you're sort of answering
sort of
cryptic question.
Okay.
All right.
We want to know.
But to me, just to wrap up our conversation. Oh boy, I tell you guys, man. That's my mama. That's right. And hey, here's a bit of trivia that you happen to say there. Here's a little bit of trivia I want everybody in the audience to know. You guys know. That's My Mama starred, Clifton Davis and Teresa Mayer, who played his mom.
Yes.
Ted Lang, who really stole the show. I got it, that whole thing. In the early to mid-70s, that was a great, you know, enjoyable, one of the few black sitcoms.
Okay.
Fast forward to when I'm in college, and I meet a young man at my college, and ironically, we're talking about Hampton Institute. It was Hampton Institute, it's Hampton University now. But I meet a young guy at my college, and we become friendly. He's hanging around the drama department. He looks kind of familiar. And it comes to find out that I've seen this guy on TV before as a young man. His name was Dennis Hines. He was a child actor. He appeared in movies. He went to the School of High School of Performing Arts, which is in New York City, which they made the movie Fame about. And he was in school with the actor Ving Rhames, a couple other people.
Yeah.
And he went on to be in the movie called Buck and the Preacher, starring Sidney Poitier and Harry Belafonte as a young child actor. And he also went on to be in a movie called To All My Friends on Shore with Bill Cosby. And he happens to be the son of Teresa Merritt, who played Clifton Davis's mom.
He
played Mama in That's My Mama. So there it is. She also created the role of Ma Rainey in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom on Broadway, which she was nominated
for.
But we got to go. Because we got to go. Because we just got 90 seconds left. I want to say thank you to Mr. historian Byron Saunders. Byron, thanks for calling in again. We'll do it again next week.
Absolutely. Happy Mother's Day to all the mothers and to you, Kay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Byron. All right. Legendary newsman, Wayne Gilbert.
I echo that sentiment. I happen to agree, Kay. I want you to have a wonderful Mother's Day. And I think say the same to all the mothers, and it's great being here as usual. See everybody next week.
Thank you, Wayne Gill. Thank you very much. Thanks, everybody, for listening to the Kay Thompson Live Show. We're on every Wednesday between 8 and 9 p.m. live on the Blog Talk Radio Network, blogtalkradio.com/Kay Thompson Live. You can listen to the show also archived if you go to that website and any show you want. As usual, I am the son, also known as Eric Payne, other co-host, and you are.
I'm Kay Thompson in pain, period.
All right. That's good enough for me. Happy Mother's Day, Ma. Happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out here. The struggle continues. Resist and lock Trump up. That's what I think anyway. That's what they used to say.
Ditto.
Keep on, everybody. Bye-bye.